Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Water Cooler, everybody. Glad you're with us. I'm David Brody. It's Monday, April 26, 2021, and this week we hit a milestone. The 100-day mark for Joe Biden is later this week. Some say that's 100 days too many. But either way, that's the reality Americans live in today. So all this week, we're going to be taking a closer look at what the Biden administration has done. Is he the new FDR, as his supporters like to think of him, or is he more like SMH, as in the shaking my head emoji? Because even he is a president that has done quite a bit of damage, a lot of folks believe, in this time in America. More in a moment. Also today, the pro-life movement on the move in Montana. A new Republican governor is good news for the pro-life movement. Three big new pro-life bills passed today. We're going to have the details. And a conversation with one of the top conservative cartoonists in the country, Anna Perez, will be along. She speaks with A.F. Branco. You don't want to miss it. But first, Joe Biden and 100 days. So let me say this right now, all right, folks? If you're looking for any sort of fair coverage of this time period from the so-called mainstream media, you're not going to find it. You're just not. They are so in the tank for Biden, it's frankly nauseating. So you want some proof? Let's go to the tape, shall we? Or how about this? I came across this story that the AP, the Associated Press, was trying to pass off as an actual news article. It's titled this, "More Action, Less Talk, Distinguished Biden's 100-Day Sprint." So let's plunge into it, all right? I hope you do have the Pepto-Bismol next to you nearby. This is some of what is in the op-ed article. Here we go. Excuse me, the op-ed article. This is actually a news story, not an op-ed, and it's written by an actual so-called reporter. Here we go. Some say he is a leader for this time. More action, less talk, and something for the history books. Already, Biden has achieved a pandemic relief package of historic breadth and taken executive actions to wrestle the country away from the legacy and agitations of President Donald Trump. Gone are the out-of-control news conferences. Gone are the sudden firings and impulsive policy declarations, both often in the form of a tweet off of the Trump year. Excuse me. He goes on to say, this is a reporter, folks. This is not an op-ed columnist. Quote, Biden wanted to occupy less of the American consciousness than did Trump, who dominated the discourse like no one else had while achieving almost nothing legislatively in his 100-day debut. The new president turned virus briefings over to the scientists and administration officials and didn't gag them. Do I have to keep reading? I'm going to read it. He filled his staff with policy experts and old administration hands, not provocateurs. The schedule on his card is full. The virus death tally inches up more slowly now. So far, he's played golf once. Oh, gosh. Someone, please. They had to get the golf dig, of course, in on Trump there at the end. Meanwhile, while reporters trip over themselves with lavish praise for Biden, Republican officials are in Orlando this week at their annual strategy meeting. So here's a memo. It was put out by the National Republican Congressional Committee. Members received this. Here is what they are reading in Orlando this week. Quote, on immigration, the NRCC writes this. As a result of Democrats' failures to stop the border crisis, independents trust Republicans over Democrats to handle the issue of immigration by plus 16 points. And then on Nancy Pelosi, this is what the NRCC is telling its members. Quote, in February, Nancy Pelosi was already the most unpopular elected official in the country at a 41% favorable, 52% unfavorable rating. Since then, Pelosi's image has dropped a net 7 points to 38% favorable, 56% unfavorable. Pelosi hit 60% unfavorable in Trump Democratic districts. Democrats in these districts are going to have an uphill battle defending their decisions to vote in lockstep with Pelosi's socialist agenda. Well, obviously, we're going to watch all of that as we head to 22. But joining me now is Tom Jones, not the singer. I want to apologize for anybody looking for Tom Jones, the singer. Instead, this is Tom Jones. He heads up the group BidenNoms.com. He's with the American Accountability Foundation. He's also the former legislative director for Senator Ron Johnson. Tom, good to see you, sir.
Hey, David, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. Sorry to disappoint your viewers, not the singer.
Well, that's fine. I mean, I think they're going to get over it, especially when they start hearing you talk about the Biden administration. Talk to us a little bit about your overall assessment of Biden's first 100 days. Your thoughts.
Well, unfortunately, I think it's been pretty successful in getting nominees through. I went back and looked at the numbers before I came on. This same time during President Trump's administration, he had gotten 26 nominees through. President Biden's gotten 33 nominees through the process already. And unfortunately, I think it's because our guys are just not fighting. And, you know, there's a long list of really problematic nominees that that we should be really concerned about that have gotten through the process.
What do you make of his overall agenda at this point? I mean, a lot of folks have said, look, H.R. 1, Quality Act, D.C. statehood, budget reconciliation. It's like the liberal, the AOC utopia list doesn't end.
It really is. And I'm a firm believer in personnel is policy. And you kind of look at the top of the list, Xavier Becerra. This is a guy who has no healthcare background, picked to lead the Department of Health and Human Services. And there's one clear reason why. He is a staunch pro-abortion radical. This is a guy who voted for partial birth abortion. More importantly, this is a guy who filed dozens of criminal complaints against the activist who exposed Planned Parenthood for selling baby parts. And this is the guy that they put in charge of the Department of Health and Human Services. It's really troubling. This is all across this administration. You've got people like Kristen Clark, Vanita Gupta. It's really troubling, and it's a leftist agenda that we need to be really concerned about.
Do I have my Senate rules correct? I mean, all it takes is a simple majority to get these nominees through, right? Because that's what Democrats did back in 2013 with Harry Reid, and now they can just go through with 50, right?
You do, but so as a former Senate staffer, you know, it's really the guys who go engage and blow up the process. It's really easy to slow things down in the Senate. So we've got this unique situation where they're going to need the vice president to be in the president's chair in the Senate to break these ties. Unfortunately, what's happening is our guys just don't have the will to fight. Now, maybe it's because the average age in the Senate is 63 years old, but these guys are just not putting in the fight every day voting against it. We don't have party discipline that force a 50-50 vote so that Kamala Harris is in Washington off the Senate floor ready to vote instead of running around New Hampshire running for re-election already. It's really disappointing that our leadership hasn't really kept our guys in line to really slow down the process here.
Well, that's interesting. So you're saying the Republicans, not only do they not keep together, stick together, but they're not even making the Democrats sweat too much on this stuff.
No, I mean, the Senate is all about operating on unanimous consent, all about get along, go along. And if our leaders had the will to go down there and blow this process up and say, look, you guys need to get out the cots and we're going to be working through all night because none of our guys are going to bail off and let this process go through. Yeah, they could really blow up the process and make a big difference here.
Mm-hmm. Kristen Clark, let's talk about her. She's nominated to be Assistant Attorney General in the Civil Rights Division. I mean, what? They're now apparently there's some emails out there where she compared cops to the KKK. Yeah. What in the world's going on here?
Yeah, I don't know where they find these people. they certainly don't do a good job vetting these people. We had to step in and do some of this vetting for the Biden administration. And yeah, we were digging through the archives. She's sending around journal articles where the author is comparing the police to the Ku Klux Klan. She organized a conference in 1999 when she was a law student at Columbia University where she had a live from death row with a guy who killed a police officer. This guy shot a police officer in the face on the streets of Philadelphia. She thought it'd be great to turn this guy into a rock star and do a live from death row video in April of 1999. I don't know where they find these people, but this is the woman who's going to be investigating the Minneapolis police, the new announced investigation of the Louisville police. This is who the Biden administration thinks needs to lead civil rights. Really, really disappointing, really problematic.
What's the latest on that as it relates to Republicans sticking together, at least against her nomination?
Yeah, I think they're sticking together, but, you know, we've got the Murkowskis, the Collinses of the world. They get off the reservation and just, you know, vote for Vanita Gupta, vote for these other terrible nominees. And, you know, if one breaks off, then the process is the skids are just greased and these guys go right through. So for the time being, you know, there's been a coalesce of opposition around Clark, but we need to hold together our weak sisters and our retirement caucus in the Senate, make sure these guys don't get off the reservation.
Listen, I got to tell you, one thing about Trump, you know, I know, warts and all, he had a lot of stuff going on, but obviously a lot of people love him. One thing, he came in and he said, no more Mr. Nice Guy. You know, like, yeah. In other words, Democrats, they, you know, a lot of folks believe that Democrats play dirty. But Republicans, for some reason, they don't get down as much in the mud. I know if liberals are hearing this, they'll say, oh, they get down in the mud, too. But the truth of the matter is, I'm not convinced of that.
Yeah, and, you know, the great thing about when we do get into that fight, that's when the media is forced into covering it. When our guys are all touchy-feely and play nice and want to be collegial, nobody pays attention to that. Nobody understands these nominees. But we get down in the fight. We talk about how bad these people are. We get down and really get in the mud with these folks. Then the attention comes in. When the fight's excited, that's when the media attention is. That's when the American people really learn about how radical these nominees are.
Well, they always say personnel is policy. Why don't you talk a little bit about that? Because what do these nominations mean? They get through, and what is that? What's the signal? What is that sending? What does that mean for America, Tom?
Sure. So, you know, there is a technical expertise to growing government. It takes work. And what matters here is, you know, the first round of cabinet nominees, those folks are important, but it's those sub-cabinet level folks that are doing the day-to-day work. They're giving the guidance to the careers. They're putting out the regulations. They're vetting the next judges. If those people get through, it really makes it a lot easier for the administration to execute on our agenda. That's why we want to gum up the works, because the fewer of those people you get into the administration, the harder it is for them to execute on the agenda. We saw it during the Trump administration. You know, we had our own folks that had trouble getting through the process, and we couldn't get them through. We couldn't get that American First agenda through the administration, much less through the Hill.
Well, Tom Jones, really appreciate you being with us. Hopefully, maybe you'll do a singing career as in addition to what you're doing there. I really appreciate you.
Hey, thanks a lot.
All right, Tom Jones, not to be confused with, let's be honest, the rock star of the 60s and 70s. Look it up. Am I dating myself, Madison? I'm dating myself, right? I know. Anyhow, Tom Jones, look it up. And type in Tom Jones, it's not unusual, anyhow. When we come back, pro-life legislation in Montana going full force. Why? Because the governor is a big-time pro-life Republican and he's signing so much legislation, we're going to catch up when we come back.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome back to the Water Cooler, everybody. In Montana, and really in so many different states across the country, they are passing a lot, tons of pro-life legislation. And let's be clear, folks, pro-lifers are winning the debate here in America. Now, I know on same-sex marriage, they're not. On the transgender issue, they're not. But from a Judeo-Christian standpoint, when it comes to the pro-life issue, legislation is indeed being passed at the state level. And I know Joe Biden's in control at the federal level. Sometimes you need to just step back for a moment and think about a little bit from the forest from the trees situation. In other words, there was a pastor one time that said, take care of your own bean patch. I will never forget he said that. He said, take care of your own bean patch. You got to do what's right in front of you in your neighborhood, in your local district, in your state, and in your city. And that's what's going on. So, for example, in Montana, they've got, and I've got a whole list of bills I can read for you here, but there's the Born Alive Infant Protection Act, for example, being signed into law by the Republican governor there. There's the Pain Capable bill as well. That means that a baby feels pain. And that you can't abort the baby after 20 weeks. So that's being passed. And I can just go on down the list. Chemical abortion, also on the list. This is something the Susan B. Anthony list, who we've had on before, Marjorie Dannenfelser, the president of SBA, has been very vocal on chemical abortion. So we're going to talk a lot about that right now. Sue Leibel with us from SBA list, the state policy director. Sue, good to have you here on the show.
Great to have to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, Sue, tell me about, I kind of ran down some of these bills, but what's happening in Montana? Because I tell you what, there's a lot of action in that state.
There is. And today's a big day in Montana. And I might add that elections have consequences, because bills that the former governor vetoed, Governor Gianforte has the honor of signing today. That would be a bill requiring ultrasound, a woman to have the option to see ultrasound before her abortion, which we know is very effective. Pain-capable Unborn Child Protection Act, so can't abort a baby at the point that it feels the pain of it. And then an expanded regulatory scheme for chemical abortion, the pills, the new frontier, which is the abortion pills. And Montana will be putting in some regulations for that.
Well, let's explore that new frontier on chemical abortion. Why don't you explain to our audience what you're talking about specifically and why it's a new frontier?
Sure. The chemical abortion pills were actually approved by the FDA in 2000. That's right. 21 years ago, with some risk protocols. The FDA said, this is dangerous, so you're going to have a doctor do this in person. You're going to have some blood tests done beforehand. You're going to have to do some certain things before you just give these pills out because they're dangerous. Well, under a new Biden-Harris administration, unfortunately, they don't feel like that may be as important. And last week, the FDA announced that it will no longer enforce the in-person dispensing requirement. Mm-hmm. This is a very scary thing for us, because we know that if a woman has an ectopic pregnancy, for example, where the baby has been stuck in the fallopian tube, these pills have a 40% greater chance of complication and she could die. Also, they just have a 4 times greater complication rate than surgical abortions anyway. So they're turning their back, really, on health and safety standards in the name of profits and the name of easier access to abortion.
Right. So basically pop it in the mail, so to speak, and don't have to worry about the in-person appointment.
Yeah, they're actually trying out a new system of DIY, do it yourself abortions, mm-hmm. by mail. Well, by default, you don't have any medical oversight when you do that. But we know that these pills are 4 times greater than the old-fashioned surgical way to begin with. So they're really playing fast and loose with these dangerous pills, and I'm sure that they're aware of it.
Sue, talk to me about the court fight ahead. You have the Sixth Circuit ruling a certain way on the Ohio abortion discrimination ban, and then you had the Seventh Circuit ruling something different on a different, on a similar piece of legislation. So where is this going exactly? It seems like everyone, especially the pro-life community, is begging the Supreme Court to rule on something along these lines.
Well, I think what you're seeing is the legacy of President Trump's ability to appoint judges to the circuit courts throughout the United States. And of course, the hope that the Supreme Court justices that are his legacy brings us in the pro-life movement. So you're seeing states really hopping on the stick to pass very strong pro-life restrictions, trying to get bills up to the Supreme Court. And we see that especially with, like, as you mentioned, you know, the bills that would not allow discrimination in abortion, like if a baby has Down syndrome or because of its gender or its race. And so we've had the Seventh Circuit and the Eighth Circuit, unfortunately, overturn those laws for Indiana, for Arkansas and other states. But the Sixth Circuit last week upheld the discrimination ban for babies with Down syndrome in Ohio. And the Tennessee bill was also in the Sixth Circuit. So now we have a circuit split. We've got one circuit saying one thing and another saying another. And that's what the Supreme Court is looking for. They're looking for that split so that they come in and be the arbiter of that.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. So I want to get a quick question about the Supreme Court. But first, I want to ask you about the Sixth Circuit. So is that a direct result of Trump's federal appeals judges? Was there a shift on the Sixth Circuit or no?
There was. He made additional appointments, and that brought a strong pro-life decision.
Okay. Got it. And as we've got about a minute left or so, but I just want to understand. So on the Supreme Court, let's just lay it out there. John Roberts has been MIA. I mean, I don't know where he's going to be on the life issue specifically, but he is not a reliable part of that 6-3 block on the Supreme Court. What's your take?
Well, I think you're right. We're not really sure what will happen there, but we know that we have seen Justice Gorsuch, Justice Amy Coney Barrett was the most recent. Mm-hmm. We really feel like this is the court is in the best position it's been in quite some time, if ever. It's never good baseball to predict what's going to happen on the Supreme Court. Yeah. So I won't be making a judgment there, but we do know that there's a lot more hope and there's a lot more possibility now on the court for the pro-life issue than ever before.
Well, Sue Leibel, State Policy Director for SBA, really appreciate you being here. A lot of hope there, and also definitely in Montana today. Really appreciate you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Great to have her on. We'll get Marjorie Dannenfelser on hopefully next week. We'll kind of get an update and move forward on that. All right. When we come back, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake will be here. She's been on the show before, former mayor of Baltimore. She Democrat, liberal, sure. We'll talk to her about policing in America and what is the bipartisan solution here exactly. Is there one? Back in a moment.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome back to the Water Cooler, everybody. Policing in America. What is the way forward? Is there a bipartisan solution? We hear a lot of talk. When is the action going to happen? And if the action does happen, what is it going to look like? Let's get some answers from Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, former mayor of Baltimore, and back with us on the show. Stephanie, always great to see you.
Great to be with you today.
Well, we haven't talked since the Chauvin verdict came down. Why don't we start there? Just kind of get your sense of what happened there and what it means going forward in America. What were some of your initial thoughts on that?
So my initial thought is that it's justice for George Floyd and any other victim at the hands of aggressive policing. You know, it's more than a verdict. It requires all of us who are committed to police reform to actually show up when there are hearings, to testify, to write to our elected officials. So while I was heartened that overwhelming evidence that the jury saw, heard, and believed the overwhelming evidence, that does not change a system that allows officers who should not wear the badge to be police officers across this country.
Yeah. So then the question becomes, what's the road forward here? What's the blueprint? I mean, there's kind of like the Democrat liberal agenda on this about, you know, no chokeholds, and they want, you know, they want to lift immunity and stuff. There's that, and then there's like what can really happen in Congress with the Republic potentially bipartisan support. What's kind of the prescription? Where do you think is the middle ground here, or is there any middle ground?
So I don't know if there's middle ground with this Congress. I like to stay optimistic because, you know, I'm a mom. I have a teenage daughter. I want to believe in my heart that our country's best days are ahead of us. But I see a level of gridlock and almost tribalism in our Congress today that is disheartening. We deserve better. We deserve a Congress that is about the business of our country, not just arguing. So, you know, I don't know if there's middle ground. I would say that part of a path forward has to be the police union and police officers' organizations acknowledging the fact that they have a problem. And while the overwhelming majority of police officers who are wearing the badge do so with honor and put their lives on the line every single day that they show up to work, there are a few that make it dangerous for those good officers and dangerous for the communities that they are supposed to protect. And they need to police themselves.
Well, I 100% agree with you. One bad apple spoils the whole bunch, if you will. And in this case, more than one bad apple, quite a few bad apples. But here's the thing. What you just said there, Stephanie, is exactly right. It was nice of you, or not, I say nice of you, it was accurate of you to say that the majority of police officers are putting on the badge every day and trying to do the best they can. But there are bad apples out there for sure. So then the question becomes on the immunity issue. I know Democrats want to basically allow folks to potentially sue a police officer. Specifically, Republicans like Tim Scott are saying, well, wait a minute. How about you sue the actual police organization, the police organization.
Yeah, the city.
The city. What do you think about that as a former mayor of Baltimore?
You know, I have mixed feelings. There needs to be a way to hold individual officers accountable. But I don't think that the qualified immunity in and of itself solves that issue.
Yeah.
I think we need to do a better job of pre-screening officers. I think we need to do a better job of in ongoing maintenance and ongoing evaluation of officers to make sure that they are fit to serve. We need to do a better job identifying those officers with red flag behaviors. I don't think we're going to get to where we need to be by dealing with the qualified immunity, which means we're dealing with something after the fact. We need to spend more time trying to prevent something like what we saw with George Floyd happening again.
Yeah, you know, I can go down the list and go to Trayvon Martin and every you know, just down the whole list. And here's George Floyd, the George Floyd case. You would think that this would be, quote, the one. It feels a little bit like the gun control debate, too, where, you know, well, this mass shooting at a school, this is going to be the one that pulls it over the finish line. But I'm with you in this camp of I don't have any confidence in this Congress to do anything.
Well, it's not, and I don't want to blame just the Congress. A lot of this is about what citizens are willing to do.
Yeah.
As far as being advocates. I mean, when we consider advocacy, a tweet or a Facebook post or just showing up at a march without doing the follow-up work, the NRA wins when it comes to gun control and the police unions win when it comes to police reform. We have to be vigilant and active, not just in the streets, but in state capitals across this country, in city halls across this country. We have to be present when the decisions are being made.
Yeah, by the way, did you kind of cringe a little bit like everybody else did when Nancy Pelosi said, thank you, George Floyd, for sacrificing your life for justice? I mean, that wasn't quite, yikes. I don't think that was...
You know, I don't... I think I've certainly been guilty of misspeaking, and the sentiment in my heart not necessarily matching the words coming out of my mouth. Mm-hmm. So I don't, she is a human, and all of us are fallible. And the same grace that I give anyone who says that they misspoke or they said something it was really not. It didn't come out the way that they wanted. I extend that grace to her and anyone else, and I hope that it is extended to me.
Fair enough. Stephanie Rawlings Blake, former mayor of Baltimore. Great to see you again on the show. Thanks for coming back.
Missed
ya. Oh, thank you so much. Missed ya. She went Southern there. Wait, she's the former mayor of Baltimore. She's saying missed ya. Well, that was very nice. We think she's great. And here's why. It's important to have a conversation in America about this issue, about a lot of different issues. We'll have her back on. We'll talk about the issue of systemic racism, because that's a touchy subject. But she has a point of view. You might not agree with it. That's okay. We need to get out of our cocoons in America and start talking to one another. Boy, I'm working up a sweat, which is a good thing because I kind of lose weight that way. All right, Anna Perez next with the conservative cartoonist.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard,
We think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Welcome back to the Water Cooler, everybody. Hey, look, for a party that is compromised of the, quote, creatives of society, you know, actresses and artists, you name it, Democrats' approach to humor and art these days is alarmingly Stalinistic. Meanwhile, on the conservative front, the creativity is booming. When it comes to memeing and political cartoons, some have even credited meme makers and cartoonists for Trump's win in 2016. Well, Real America's Voice correspondent Anna Perez had a chance to sit down with a leading voice in the world of political cartoons. He's nationally syndicated political cartoonist Tony Branco. He's also known as AF Branco. To talk about his work, here's what he had to say.
Under Trump, I feel like you saw more of this, I guess, resurgence of like me making political cartoons. I felt like it really blew up during that time. Did you feel like that was a good opportunity for you as a political cartoonist?
Yeah, it gives me an opportunity to really focus in on a point, make a critical point that I feel needs to be made, whereas an op-ed piece or long, or an interview or something on television, a talking head may be able to really get into it, whereas a cartoon, you have to make a specific point, and they're very handy for that. A lot of people aren't really focused on the issues. Cartoons are a way to exchange and share and share points and views that may not otherwise be shared.
Yeah, and I think it makes it more palatable for people. I think it's a way that people will be able to, you know, at least laugh, even if they don't necessarily agree with it. But what I think is interesting is on the left, you see this push to sort of get rid of that. They almost want a more, like, you know, serious approach to this. They can't seem to laugh at, you know, a lot of these things that even they may not agree with, but would otherwise be funny. Do you feel like you're getting a lot of backlash for that? Have you been banned anywhere at all? Has your work been censored?
Yeah, on Facebook, I've noticed it quite a bit. On Twitter, of course, just like anybody else that's conservative, where they're trying to marginalize and push us to the side. It's a great opportunity, and of course, I'm being focused in on at times, but not as much as some of the more the larger profile conservatives.
Yeah, definitely. And I also think, and I know we were talking about this before, you tackle in particular the issue of wokeness and, you know, this critical race theory that's being pushed by the Biden administration. Do you feel like people get more, that seems to be something that is a real trigger for people on the left more than anything, almost maybe that in the border, I suppose. But do you feel like people are more sensitive to those topics? What would you say is the response?
Right now, I think it's the biggest issue that we have facing conservatives right now. My pet peeve has always been the media, the biased, definitely trying to cultivate a narrative that fits their agenda. And basically the media is the talking arm of the Democrat Party. Wokeness is a little bit different. I view it more like a cancer on critical thinking. It's a cancer on our history, our humor, comedy, free speech, and honest debate. It really needs to be addressed, and I'm trying to address that through cartoons as much as possible. I equate it to the Chinese Cultural Revolution with a little bit of the French Revolution mixed in. People are losing their jobs. It's very serious. I know that cartoons are supposed to be somewhat humorous, and I try to throw a little bit of humor in there. But at the same time, it's a very, very serious issue right now. It needs to be talked about a lot more.
Well, joining me now on set, Anna herself. Anna, good to see you.
Thanks. Good to see you.
Great interview, by the way.
Thank you.
Interesting. I like your question about, you know, whether or not he was banned. I like a lot of your questions, but whether or not he was banned. I mean, you know, he's going to take some hits as a conservative out there. What was your take?
Right. Well, I think that he had a lot of great things to say. I think he brought up a really good point when he compared this almost to the French Revolution, to what's happening in China right now. And to your point at the beginning, it's so true that What we're seeing right now is that the creativity is far more on the right than the left, as far as doing things like creating political cartoons and creating memes. You know, for a party that, as you said, is comprised of creatives, so to speak, they're not exactly taking these hits very well as a, and you know, to his point, it's supposed to be palatable. When you receive this point in a, the form of a political cartoon, it's supposed to be, you know, pointing at hypocrisy in a playful way. But it seems to be very difficult for the left to sort of, I guess, grapple with this. And, you know, what he was talking about, I think, mostly in as far as tackling the topics of wokeness and critical race theory, those are the hardest things, I think, for them to grapple with, like taking any hits from in that area, because I think that that's all that their party has to offer right now. Things like, okay, well, we're going to make sure that, you know, white people are on the same playing field as black people, or, you know, everything's racist, everything is this. And once you take out the color of language and take out the fun of everything, you know, what do you have left?
Oh, I think that's a great point. And, you know, liberals are so uptight. I mean, they always make it sound like conservatives are uptight. I don't know if conservatives are uptight. I feel like the reason we're so, you know, conservatives are so creative is because, you know, they're frustrated, but so they got to take out their, in some sort of creative way, they got to take out a little bit of the frustration. So, you know, have a little fun with it, too.
Yeah, and, you know, this is, we also saw, like, we talked about Trump, how under Trump, this actually appealed to a lot of young people. We're seeing a lot of young conservatives that this is really resonating with. Being able to have fun, you know, make fun of things on the internet. This has been a really creative way for the Republican Party to build a base for young people because, to your point, you know, they're, liberals are no longer the party of fun. You know, it used to be years ago where they at least supported free speech pretty consistently. That was sort of their thing. And, you know, the conservatives were the fuddy-duddies. Now, you know, we're sort of, the conservatives are sort of the fun people. They're the ones who are being creative and taking advantage of, you know, what I thought was interesting in the interview is he referred to this as a great opportunity. And I think that's, that kind of shows the difference in mindsets between liberals and conservatives. Like, we are seeing this, fine, ban conservatives as much as you want, but they'll just make more and more opportunities for their voices to be heard. And, you know, political cartoons are a very creative avenue to do that.
Yeah, so that's interesting. It is a great opportunity. And if you think about it, it's kind of like the darkness before the dawn, you know, this idea of like, you know, you never know where, I mean, this is a great opportunity for conservatives to kind of strut their stuff a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure.
All right. Well, thanks, Anna. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Good stuff. All right. When we come back, more of me. Thank you so much. Though my mom would like it. Actually, coming up next is The Last Sip. I was at the White House press briefing today. I got a question in. Jen Psaki, we call it the Psaki Sot. We're going to play the Psaki Sot here in a moment. I talk about unity and infrastructure. Wait till you hear it. More of me, which I get paid at, literally by the word, so I'm kind of excited to hear more words of mine in a moment.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome back to the Water Cooler, everybody. I've got my mug out here because it's time for The Last Sip. I was at the White House briefing today. Jen Psaki, this was my question. Have a look.
Hi, David.
Hey, Jen. Hey, a question on unity. You know, you talk about earlier, you said you wanted to bring, or the president wanted to bring the country back. Together. So I guess the question is, he has not met with House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, according to Kevin McCarthy. What does that say about unity? And also there are some other legislative issues as it relates to H.R. 1 and a commission to study packing the Supreme Court, as you would say. And there's a lot of other lists as well, budget reconciliation. So there's a lot of folks, you talk about tens of millions of people, they're concerned about that this doesn't seem like unity at all.
Do you think tens of millions of people are concerned about him not meeting with Kevin McCarthy?
No, I think tens of millions of people are concerned about H.R. 1 and budget reconciliation and going with that 50-vote threshold. I think
I'm not sure the polling bears that out, but I will say that the president's view is that bringing the country together is bringing the American people together. So when I say he is focused on bringing people together, bringing Democrats and Republicans together, he's not talking about solving bipartisanship in the this zip code here. He is talking about proposing policies that address the crises that we're facing, whether it's getting the pandemic under control, putting people back to work. Yes. A lot of those policies he's proposed, whether it's the American Rescue Plan or the American Jobs Plan, are supported by the vast majority of the American public, Democrat, Republican, Independent. They certainly want to see him working with Republicans and Democrats and here. And he's absolutely doing everything he can to do that. He's had a number of Republicans down here to the Oval Office. He's looking for it. We're going to be reviewing their proposals. And I think certainly people see that, see him rolling up his sleeves and ready to work with people of all different viewpoints.
Real quick, why not separate the infrastructure bill the Republicans have, whatever it is, $800 billion or so? Why not just take that, call it unity, call it a deal, and then move on to some of the other legislative priorities within the total construct?
Well, David, as you know, you need 60 votes. You can talk to Republicans in the Senate and see how many votes they have. But I will say that where we are now is that we are certainly taking a look at the proposal. Right now, there's deep in the weeds, sometimes nerdy conversations between staffers, members of Congress. We have lots of follow-up questions. I'm sure they have lots of follow-up questions. We're sharing ideas. That's actively happening now. He'll invite some members next week, bipartisan members, to come to the Oval Office and have a discussion about it and what the path forward looks like.
Jen Psaki in the briefing room today. I got to ask a question. I also got a COVID test. I'm COVID-free. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the Water Cooler, everybody. End of the show. And I don't want Joe Weber to take this the wrong way, but it is the end of the show. Therefore, we must go to Joe Weber, the news editor at justthenews.com. Joe, don't take it the wrong way that you're not the lead story.
Last shall be first.
Thank you for the biblical reference. I think that's the Bible. Wait, let me think. All right, anyhow, tell us what's going on at justthenews.com today.
Okay, well, that didn't take long. The House Republicans are having their annual retreat. They usually try to keep a pretty tight lid on this kind of thing. I remember having covered them in years past in Hershey and at Greenbrier. They wouldn't even let you into the main room, and they would sort of come out and talk to you. But it appears as if Liz Cheney, Congresswoman from Wyoming, and then blew the lid open on some stuff today when she said that she didn't agree with House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy about how the scope of the January 6th riot investigation should go. She, McCarthy would prefer it to be more widespread, including the summer ones. Cheney said, I think I agree with the way Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, has a narrow focus of the January 6th riot. Now, this kind of what the Republicans did not want to do was blow the lid on this. They're very close to perhaps winning back the House. They didn't need to have any fireworks here. I think if there were any messaging out of this retreat was to let's try to have some unity, and this didn't really happen today. So.
Joe, yeah. I would think that at this point, Republicans have to be kind of licking their chops. I mean, this idea that they can take back the House. I mean, if they don't take back the House, that's going to be a big disappointment.
Yeah, it's theirs to lose. That's the point I was really trying to make. I would think that they would try to have some unity, not have a lot of controversy, say, look, let's just stay on message. Let's just stay on the idea that, you know, Biden is overspending with these major stimulus bills. He messed up at the border. We're going to be the party of the fiscal conservatives and not try to stop some of this infighting. But yet here it happened on the first day. That I would think that there would be a setback for them and their strategy to win back the House.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Joe Weber, good to see you, sir. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Joe Weber at the end of the show, but first in our hearts, for sure. By the way, speaking of the Republicans, you know, that NRCC memo we put out at the top of the show, we showed about all that information about Pelosi. Hey, look. They've tried to go down the Pelosi road before, and it hasn't quite worked out in some of the midterm elections. So we'll see how much damage they can do when it comes to talking negative about Nancy Pelosi. All right, that does it from the couch set. I love this couch set. I feel like Oprah. I'll be honest with you, without the money. See you tomorrow.